cultural history of the Western Hemisphere prior to the advent of the European conquerors is so dim that even although in the last 50 years a great deal of work has been done, we are still in no condition or position to arrive at conclusions or to attempt a general reconstruction of the situation. Broadly speaking, there is much evidence that the three Americas have been inhabited for a very long time. Some schools of modern anthropology are even suspecting that the records of human existence in the Western Hemisphere may be as long and old as anything to be found in the Eastern Hemisphere. Be this as it may, we are almost entirely dependent upon so-called natural records. Through the excavation of mounds and the examination of ruins, we try to piece together the story of Amerindian culture. The possibility of Asiatic influence, or even European influence, cannot be eliminated. Even when we think of comparatively early times, there is a general suspicion that this continent was populated from Asia. Certainly, there were streams of migration over what we call the Aleutian Island Chain and Bering Strait. But to me, it has always seemed a little difficult to agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Hardlicker in his thinking in this direction. It seems to me that these ancient migrations do not explain the cultural pattern that existed here at the time of the conquest. It would seem more probable that travelers, adventurers, perhaps shipwrecked mariners, did reach the western continents from some other cultured area, perhaps 2, 3, or 4,000 years ago. Something happened here that is not fully explained by any of the records now available to us. Considering, for example, the possibility of migration from Asia by other routes than those at the far north, we know that certain currents are such that it is quite possible to drift from Asia to the west coast of Central America. This drift would be very largely the result of currents which, however, are not so fortunate if the wanderer wants to drift home again. Thus, there would appear to have been the possibility of a one-way travel at a very early time from Asia. We also know that down in the Polynesian area, navigation by means of very large canoes was advanced perhaps further than we realize. We know that in these areas there are canoes that can and have traveled 3, 4, 5,000 miles. That all this western land could have remained untouched by any contact with Asia or Europe or North Africa from the dawn of time until the Columbian voyages just does not seem to make sense. We do recognize the probability that the early Nordic peoples reached the northeast coast of America And if we may trust the records in Plutarch's voyages, Greek mariners may have explored the St. Lawrence River. Certainly things did happen. And these things left real and genuine marks upon the way of life in the Western Hemisphere. I have not as yet, quite intentionally, mentioned the Atlantic hypothesis, the possibility that an Atlantic culture may have actually laid the foundation for the civilization of the Americas. There is much to suggest in the legendary and lore of the primordial inhabitants of this continent that they were aware that their culture did not originate here. They have the world deluge myth in common with most other peoples of Asia and Africa. And they have a tendency in their recordings to think toward an origin lying to the east of the American continent. This origin does not seem to be fully explained on the possibility of direct contact with Europe. For at any time when this contact would have been reasonable, Europe could not have provided that which these travelers report. So some way, we feel that a cultural impetus was given to this continent or these western lands at a time long distant. And that at the time of this cultural impetus, it arrived from peoples already themselves cultured. If, for example, such a movement had occurred 10 or 12,000 years ago, what record do we have anywhere of a civilization that could have equipped the Western peoples for the rise of such cultures as that of the Maya or the Inca? We do not know of any such culture. This would be pre-Egyptian. It would be before the rise of the Greek culture. It would be before anything we know of Chinese culture. It would even probably antedate any reasonable concept we have of Indic culture, which may be the oldest in the world. Thus, from the probable areas from which such contact could be made, there was nothing that would have provided what these people claim to have received. Perhaps then they are justified in assuming that they brought this knowledge from a land or area which has since been submerged and lost to history. We do not wish to labor this point. Our main problem is to try to understand how certain institutions, almost identical with those of classical antiquity, which arose in the Western world and resulted in the Americas becoming part of a broad world cultural pattern. We know that prior to the Columbian voyages, that the peoples of America were not all savage. We know that Cortes, when he saw for the first time the city of Mexico, said that it was the most beautiful city on earth. He called it the Venice of the Western Hemisphere. And he said there was no city in Europe that was its equal. These people, therefore, had advanced far in art and sciences, and were gradually building themselves a solid political situation. This, however, was interrupted and was never permitted to mature. Yet we must also realize that the city of Mexico, with all its grandeur, with the Aztec-Toltec culture complex behind it, was relatively uncivilized in comparison to the great empire of the Maya lying further to the south. For if the Aztec peoples were coming into cultural maturity, it was because they had derived their inspiration and their guidance from the more southerly tribes. It is hardly right to think of these people as tribes. They were much more than this. They were nations. They were not only nations, but they were great social commonwealths. They had good laws. And with that strange directness of spirit which so often marks these old cultures, they had found remedies for many evils which plague us even today. Many of their laws were wiser and better than our laws. And from what records we can find, particularly in the very marvelous compilations of Fra Bernardino de Sahagun, we know that these laws were kept, that virtues were actually cultivated by the people, that governments, for the most part, were benevolent. And as Stuart Chase points out, the Central American people hold the world's peace record, a great culture, a great civilization that lived and dwelt and flourished in peace for over 500 years. This situation was no doubt due in part to some kind of relative isolation. By the time the Maya culture had reached its zenith, there seems to have been little evidence that these people were aware of the situations existing in other parts of the world. The three Americas functioned in a strange aloofness. Their cultures developed with comparatively little interruption. They had few of the rugged inducements to intensive competition that we know. Even though some of the tribes were warlike, this warlikeness was very primitive. It was not a highly sophisticated type of warfare. And among the Mayas, if it did arise, it was entirely defensive. And these people were not, by any means or nature, militant. In fact, they were probably one of the most pacifistic of all nations to achieve cultural maturity. Now, when we speak of the great complex of the Maya or Itza culture, the Maya is one of those words that doesn't belong, but which we will never get rid of. This culture was not a small thing. It was a great culture. And had it been known earlier to Europe and Asia, probably would have been given precedence over even the cultures of Egypt and Greece in our estimation of human progress. But because it was far away and late of discovery, we have already established ourselves so firmly upon a Greco-Latin civilization that we had no intentions of changing our point of view. In the so-called jungles of Central America, extending from Middle Mexico south through the peninsula of Yucatan and down into Central America and almost as far as Panama, there was a great complex of people, a complex that produced a giant bursting of metropolitan centers, great cities, splendid roads, marvelous buildings. We do not really know the population of that area, but it must have been prodigious. It must have been indeed far greater than we realize, although we still do not know how these people fed themselves. We do not know how their culture developed so successfully with such a small amount of available soil and water. But in any event, there are scattered through these jungles over 200 cities. And one or two of these cities, at least, believe it or not, at areas larger than the city of Los Angeles. And we think we hold the world's record. We do, as of the moment. Public buildings and major edifices in a number of these cities are 30 and 40 miles apart. Great remnants of marvelous plazas, boulevards, and roads bind these things together. In some of these ruins today, and they are only partly excavated, 50 or 100 public buildings of vast size group around some forgotten core of culture. 200 such cities, connected by good highways, roads that lead almost into the United States, and may have at one time extended as far as Montana on the north and the Andes on the south. We cannot truly estimate, but the city of Chichen Itza on the peninsula of Yucatan, if it was the thriving community that its buildings now indicate, could well have housed 3 or 4 million people. Yet all of it is gone. It was gone long before the Spaniards came. Where these people came from, we really do not know. Where they went, we really do not know. We have many interesting and ingenious theories, but these theories do not all add up. And although there are some who are pretty positive in their thinking, the fact really remains that a great culture arose and disappeared. That this culture was not too remote, we also realize, because the Aztecs were in contact with it, and they were not a particularly ancient people. But down on the peninsula of Yucatan, we had a civilization that produced great astronomers, whose calendar was so good that the Spaniards borrowed it to correct their own, with great institutions of medicine, a highly socialized state where there was no poverty, a highly benevolent institutional government. For while it is said that both the Mayas and the Aztecs had their emperors, and we think of them as monarchies, we should not forget that the emperors were elected, not by heredity, and that when an emperor died, his son did not succeed him. A new emperor was elected. Therefore, we had the beginning of an electional type of government. We also know that these people were highly advanced in hydraulics, that they were splendidly equipped in art, and some of the more recent paintings discovered in the temples of Bonampak and among the ruins of the old Lacandon culture would indicate that these paintings and sculptures might well have arisen in Western Asia, perhaps even in Japan. All these mysteries finally center around the supreme mystery in the life of the people. That is the mystery of its religion. Every great culture that has ever arisen has had to have a great spiritual impetus behind it. We have no trace or track of the what might be termed indigenous religion of a primitive Amerindian. We do not know of any such religion. From the records in Central America, such as have been preserved, everything points to the fact that the faiths of all these peoples were imported doctrines. They came from elsewhere. In the great Maya culture area, which was the most advanced of the three, three names stand out as representing the great religious leaders. The first and most important of all these, of course, was Itzamna, the father of the Itzas, the mysterious patriarch who, like a second Noah, led his people across the oceans in ships to the peninsula of Yucatan to escape some deluge that destroyed the ancient islands of mud. Zamna is pictured in the arts of his people as an old man, either toothless or with a single crooked fang, with a large and disproportionately shaped nose. He was the son of Hunab-Ku, Lord of the Sky, was believed to have been immaculately conceived, and he brought his people not only out of another land into safety, but established among them the basic principles of their religion. He was their enlightener. He was the great teacher of these people. The second name that arises in this complex of culture is the name of Votan. Votan, founder of the Votanic culture empire at Palenque, is again a mysterious god. He also came from beyond the sea, from another world. He was immaculately conceived. He was wise. And when he established the great temple town of Palenque, he built there the House of Darkness, where the secrets and records of his people and their origins, all these important details, are said to have been properly preserved. This was also the same Votan who was called later the Navigating Serpent, because it was believed that in a ship he actually made the journey to the Mediterranean, visited the Temple of Solomon, and saw the ruins of the Tower of Babel. This all belongs to culture legends, but some of them we do not really feel inclined to entirely disregard. The third and probably the best known of these culture leaders of this area was Kukulcan, the feathered serpent. He was born of the morning star, conceived of a virgin. He came from a mysterious land far away, the land of the seven colors. And he came and he brought to his people the blessings of wisdom and civilization. He was their great hero. And the totemic mask of Kukulcan is still one of the most sacred emblems to be found among the ruins of these ancient civilizations. Under other names, either as Gucomax or later as Quetzalcoatl, this deity of the feathered serpent was venerated throughout Mexico and up into the southern tribes of the United States. Here were the great culture heroes, the founders of the mysteries. We know that the peoples of this region celebrated religious rites. We know that the Spaniards, when they first came here, were horrified by these rites. Not horrified because the rites were sanguine or terrible, but horrified because it appeared to them that these people were worshiping or practicing a false Christianity. This record is very clearly noted. And one of the reasons we are so impoverished at this time is because of the wholesale destruction of the manuscripts and books of these people by the early missionaries. These missionaries were insulted and probably quite piously disturbed by the fact that a so-called heathen, uncultured people could have such a religion. You can imagine what a missionary would feel like if he asked one of these Indians in their strange befeatheredness what he believed. And this Indian replied, as one of them did. He said, "I believe in one God manifesting through three persons, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost." Yet these Indians hadn't learned this from Spaniards. The only answer the Spaniards could think of was that the devil had been working overtime. Only an infernal power could have caused these strange and distant people to have religious rites so similar to their own. For they learned that the son of the great god Bacab, the one and only begotten, had died for his people, had atoned with his own blood for their sins, and that even now the remnants, and there are not many, of the Lacandones still celebrate the Eucharist with the blood of the martyred God. The answer is pretty evident. There had to have been a tremendous culture platform underneath this people. One of the sources of our knowledge of these peoples and their mysteries are the Chilambalam, the sacred books of the headmen of the villages. The great Chilambalam of Cozumel was for many years stored in the library at Merida, but after one of our enthusiastic archaeological teams passed through the area, the book disappeared and has never been seen again. In polite language, it was simply stolen. But in these books, which contain the record of the antiquity of the people, of their laws, of their morals, of their ethics, we know that we are dealing with a great culture and a highly advanced one. There are a number of interesting and sometimes amusing names that have been bestowed upon the buildings and the various ruined complexes of Central America. For example, at Chichen Itza, there is a building called the Nunnery, undoubtedly so called because there never were any nuns near it. This building, which was just named because it looked like an old-fashioned European monastery, or nunnery to some degree, has near it the only three-story building found in that particular complex. And on the end of that building is another little building called the chapel, or an ecclesia. And over the door of this sits the great God of Heaven, seated like the Orphic deity in the luminous egg, adorned with the plumes of the Quetzal bird, surrounded by the radiance of eternal light. This mysterious being is the Heaven One, the one great God, represented as the Hindus did their Brahma, seated or standing in an egg. This deity has never been explained. Everyone who has tried to study this philosophy and these ideas has been blocked by the lack of evidence, by the lack of continuity of thought, and the fact that nearly everything we do have has been filtered through the Spaniards, which did no particular credit to the Indians by intention, and a lot of discredit to the Spaniards by consequence. The few good Spanish recorders came too late, and the whole subject is locked in an almost impenetrable darkness. At Uxmal, we also have the same mystery. Over the city rises the great pyramid temple of Adivino, the house of the dwarf. What it really was, we do not know. There is also a little building, little in what we see, which is called the Dovecot, so named because of the curious open work of the front elevation of the building. But what interests us is that the front wall is over 2,000 feet from the back wall. So we had quite a building when it was in good condition. Most of these buildings stood upon great artificial pyramids. And the impressiveness of the structures touches us even when we look upon their present ruins. So out of what we have, I made quite a careful study to do what we could with this subject. from the available codices, which are not too numerous, and from some of the earlier Western students, European students, like Lord Kingsborough, who are called visionaries, and from the probings and wanderings of men like Dr. Laplonjon, who is considered a little mad. Out of all of these things put together, we try to piece into some kind of pattern the story of what the religion and belief of these people might have been and how their religions were celebrated. Everywhere, the serpent appears. The serpent which has been connected with religious worship all over the world. Whether it be the Nagas of India or Cambodia, whether it be the winged seraphs of the Mongolian desert, or the serpents of the Egyptian glyphs, or the ancient serpents of the priestesses of the mysteries of Samothrace, everywhere the serpent coils out of the case that holds the book. And we find it so represented on the early coinage of the Greek states. The serpent to these people certainly represented wisdom. The winged serpent, which was almost the dragon, was their emblem of adeptship, or of a secret initiation into the mysteries. Their guardian spirits and angel, their mysterious defender, was the Quetzal bird, itself, again, a form of the phoenix. So out of the mysteries of these people come the same symbols that were used in other nations to convey the idea of initiation into the mysteries. The temples of these people, like those of Asia and the Near East, were nearly always subterranean to represent the serpent's hole. Those who went down through the mysterious passageways pass through again the same harrowing experiences that are recorded on the other side of the earth. The only book that we have now that really gives us some little consolation and insight into the mysteries of these people is the Popol Vuh. So this is the mysterious sacred book of the Kichi. And in this, we have a complete story of initiation ritual. We then also begin to suspect the reason for some of the strange buildings that exist in this area. For there are certainly isolated structures far away from the general concourse of the people. Why one or two vast temples should arise by themselves in the wet jungle of Palenque or the dry jungle of Yucatan, we do not know. But somewhere amidst the barrenness of a most inhospitable region, you will see the gaunt bones of a great house, something that must in its glory, when it was covered with the bright pigmentation that ornamented the elaborate and intricate stuccoed designs, these buildings must have been things of extraordinary beauty. But why were they there? I think the Popol Vuh tells us that part of the training and the upbringing of the young warrior or the young citizen was that he had to make a journey, the mysterious journey that the initiates of all mysteries throughout the world have taken. He had to journey into the wilderness and there go to one of the great shrines or sanctuaries of his people. Apparently in this region, the tendency was for the university temples to be isolated rather than to stand in the midst of cities. Now, what these temples really were, perhaps we can gather from comparison with the Egyptian. A number of scholars have sensed that there was some parallel between the Maya situation and the doctrines and philosophies of Egypt, and a number of identical symbols have been found in the languages of both these people, the written languages, with the same meanings. Therefore, there is some hope in the idea that there was a connection here at a remote time. In any event, the truth seeker went forth to prove himself. The same situation occurs on a less elaborate level among the North American Indian tribes, where it was the duty of the young man to go into the forest or into the wilderness and perform vigil for the attainment of his manhood, and in order that he might, in dream or vision, receive the name or identity of his totem or his guardian spirit. Now, of course, in the North American area, the civilization had not sufficiently developed so that institutional mysteries could exist. But in these Latin American regions, these did exist. So the young man went out in search of truth. He went out to become an initiate in his own right, to be worthy to bear the insignia of the serpent, and also to have hovering over him the protecting wings of the bird of paradise. What happened when he reached these priestly temples, we are not too sure. Even the Popol Vuh does not tell us too much. But there is the suspicion that they represented much the same thing as the priestly institutions of Egypt. Here, in all probabilities, the neophyte was accepted into the lore and legendary of his tribe. He sat with the wise ones. He sat with those who were learned. He sat with those who knew the stories of old things, and probably also with the professors of such arts and sciences as flourished in his day. I think we can safely say that higher education, as it was known to these people, was acquired through these princely or priestly institutions. It is quite possible, however, that the simple forms of knowledge were communicated in the communities themselves. And we are now dealing with a people that had a splendid and very complex written language, more difficult to interpret than the Chinese, and sufficiently subtle so that any type of scientific, literary, or poetic work could be adequately composed in it. We had a great language. More than 5,000 to 6,000 of its characters have already been identified, although not understood. So it was probably the higher knowledge, the knowledge of those things closest to the hearts and souls of men, that came through these priestly institutions. From one end of this culture to the other, we know that these people believed definitely that certain persons from among their tribes possessed supernatural powers. Wherever we have this legend of prophets or patriarchs, of ancient sages who could raise the dead and heal the sick, who had powers to stop the winds and quell the storms, had powers to see into the hearts of men and to gaze into mirrors of obsidian and read the minds of peoples at a great distance. Wherever such legends gather, we are suspicious that we are in the presence of some kind of a hierarchy which taught secret arts. We cannot assume that this type of knowledge not only came into existence, but was accepted as a symbol of authority and virtue. We cannot assume this to happen unless such institutions exist. For where supernatural powers appear among uncultured peoples, they are held in fear and disregard, and the performers of them are supposed to be witches or sorcerers. This is not the case, however, if the whole nation understands that these represent superior attributes, as in Egypt and Greece. So these people undoubtedly did have secret arts, and did practice them, and were instructed in them, and these have always been part of religion. So in the mysteries of Habalba, practiced or described in the Popol Vuh as taking place in a remote and mysterious temple in the wilderness, we are certainly in the presence of one of these initiation systems. In this particular rite, the usual circumstances are unfolded. The candidates for initiation pass through horrible experiences. They are tested. It appears that they cannot survive. They must fight against monsters. They must disentangle their minds from witchcraft and sorcery. They must remain true to their principles and hold their courage against the most terrible temptations. And finally, having gone through experiences as fantastic as anything described in the Arabian Nights entertainment, which incidentally is a similar kind of work, these candidates accepted finally into the temple as having proved themselves, their characters, and their resolutions, were then feasted, brought into the presence of a blessed spectacle, were given honor and recognition, and were safely rescued from all their difficulties. In other words, it is the typical story of man journeying through the underworld of ignorance in search of light, and finding this light by means of an organized institution, a priestly school, in which the secrets of the soul were communicated to those entitled to receive them. That such institutions existed throughout the Mayan complex, we know. We know also that from the records of these people, that their legends and their lore remind us much of the legends of the prophets of ancient Israel and other parallel culture groups. Lord Kingsborough was of the opinion that some early Christian apostles or evangelists must have reached the Western Hemisphere in the first century and have been responsible for some of these beliefs. And he even suspects that Quetzalcoatl, the savior god of Mexico, who is described as a fair person, mitered, and wearing a robe adorned with crosses, might possibly have been one of the apostles who went forth, perhaps for some entirely different region, but was cast by adverse conditions upon the shore of the Western Hemisphere. That such a thing could have occurred is possible. For up to the present time, we have no accurate report on the lives of 6 or 7 of the 12 original apostles. But we don't know too much about this. Anything might be possible. If St. Thomas reached India, why could not some other early saint have reached the Western Hemisphere? It is also possible that it would have been feasible for some Christian who had reached deep Asia to make the journey to the Western world. It is known that the Chinese reached the coast of California sometime in about 300 B.C., bringing with them certain plant life and other living forms which are not to be found here, and leaving several engraved stones along our seaboard, some of which are still in existence. But in any event, from the Popol Vuh, and from the remaining mysteries that have been preserved in sculpturing and in early transcriptions derived from the Christianized Indians under Spanish supervision, the pageantry unfolds pretty systematically, and we can come to only one broad conclusion, which, however, we cannot entirely fill in, and that is that sacred rites, similar to those of Egypt in India, Greece, and Rome, were celebrated here for the same reasons and under almost the same symbols and with a similar insight into the essential meaning of human consciousness and the mysteries of human life. A number of the old Aztec manuscripts which have survived are cosmological, showing the construction of the universe. And most of these cosmological documents are rather parallel to the old Chaldean beliefs relating to these things. In fact, a number of students of North American Indian philosophy have declared that the Indian cosmos, the Indian concept of the universe, throughout the eastern part of the United States and even into the Western Plains Indians, that this general concept is definitely Babylonian and can be almost traced in the monuments of Assyria and Persia and other similar areas. Now, with this thinking, we can turn from the Maya, which certainly possessed the highest form of this culture, to a brief thought concerning the Aztec further to the north. We know that the Aztec was the spiritual child of the Maya. The Aztec had not yet developed a full written language, but was moving toward it very rapidly at the time of the conquest. The Aztec was a more warlike, more sanguine temperament than the Maya. He was a more aggressive man by nature. But even with all this aggressiveness, he had a certain sense of honor and a certain integrity. And I think that the so-called savagery of these people has been largely exaggerated by the Spaniards, who insisted on finding some justification for trying to exterminate them. Actually, if the truth were known, these people had many good points, although it is possible that, like many other peoples who are in a semi-savage state, that they practice certain destructive excesses. But their religious system was founded again upon the cult of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. We know that their morality among their own people was excellent. We know that they had good laws and that they administered them justly. We also know that their rulers were also priests, that it was a theocratic state, that they surrounded themselves with philosophers, scholars, mystics, psychics, astrologers, and others of similar caliber, and that the government was administered in harmony with the spiritual leadership which governed and directed the people. We know also from contemporary records that these seers and astrologers accurately predicted the coming of the Spaniards long before they arrived and warned the Emperor of Mexico to prepare himself. But the Mexicans had really no way of preparing themselves, because they had no idea whatever as to the propensities of the stranger. They were not prepared to defend themselves against him. They had nothing to compare to his horse or his gun. And it is said that the Western Hemisphere was captured or was finally conquered by a horse and a blunderbuss. These things the Indians could not cope with. But in any event, these Indians in the northern regions likewise had a religion that was essentially morally just. They had a belief in this deity, Quetzalcoatl. They believed him to be a master artisan. And if they had a cult that can be paralleled to anything that we know of in the old world, perhaps it would be parallel to the Dionysian artificers of the Greeks. The cult of Quetzalcoatl was the cult of the artificers. He was represented most anciently in a long robe. He was a master of workmen. He carried with him the power to melt and work metals. He was a master architect. He could prepare and design buildings. He was indeed a kind of combination of the Greek artificer and the medieval European guildmaster. It is said even by the Spaniards that the men who brought with him belonged to a guild, and that these guildsmen were the ones that introduced into this area the making of fine jewels, the making of beautiful ornaments, the casting of metals for the adornment of temples and palaces, and for the adornment of persons. But these same ones also built all kinds of devices, instruments, and machines, that they were skilled in invention, and that under their tutelage, these people learned how to build cities, to bring water to them, to create sewerage, to orient their buildings, to achieve the penetration of light into the inner rooms of a building through careful reflection of light from slanted walls, that they were able to drain their building so that a cup of water placed on the top of the most complicated edifice would ultimately drain to the ground. All of these things showed a highly advanced skill. Where did this man come from? Where did this singing band of workmen come from, who came all the way down to Chulalongkorn, who came singing down the countryside in a great procession, led by this magnificent man leaning on his staff, this man who wore the apron of a stonemason, or something of that nature? This would be a golden holiday for students of early Freemasonic tradition, because it seems as though something of this nature must be indicated. In the complexes of buildings in Central America and also in Mexico, Masonic aprons, both square and triangular, are noted, and the great mystical symbol of the red hand is to be found upon these buildings, a red hand which also appears almost identically upon the ruins of Angkor Wat in Cambodia. It is easy enough to toss these thoughts into discard, but it is not very easy to work out an answer that is big enough to take them all in. Yet this has to happen sometime, or we will never come to the end of our riddle. We do not actually know also whether under the heading of Kukulcan, the feathered serpent, or Gucomatz, that means the same, or Quetzalcoatl, which has the same meaning, whether we are dealing with one person or more than one person. The Mexican archaeologists, and also a good many of the German ones, are now inclined to think that this term, the feathered serpent, might have the same generic significance as the term Zoroaster in Persia. There were at least 9 Zoroasters living at widely different times, whose lives were mingled into one story. There were probably 5 persons who have been combined to make the story of Orpheus that we now have in the Greek. There were probably 5 persons by the name of Orpheus, whose name simply means, by the way, the Dark One, who finally mingled their stories and their adventures to make the one Orphic fable we know. It is quite conceivable that the story of Quetzalcoatl is not the story of one man alone, but the story of a culture hero, a hero that was reborn again and again. It is quite possible that a person attaining to a certain degree of exaltation, perhaps the Hierophant of the Mysteries, assumed the name and became the living exponent of the original doctrine. And just as one after another the popes of Rome took upon themselves the title Pontifex Maximus, so it is quite possible that in these central Indian areas a traditional descent of leaders all took the totem of Quetzalcoatl, or the symbol of the feathered serpent, to themselves. In any event, when we go into this area around Mexico City, particularly at the pyramids of the Sun and Moon at San Juan Teotihuacan, the monuments there would imply a greater antiquity than we are inclined to assume. The American archaeologists say they were built about 1,200, 1,500 years ago. German archaeologists think they were built 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. And some of the Mexican archaeologists I have talked to about it shrug their shoulders in typical Latin manner and say, well, maybe 6,000, maybe 8,000 years, who knows? So the situation here is not exactly clear either. The old records of the Mexican people, like the records of the Egyptians about their pyramids, are fairly concise, however. The earliest records of the Mexicans imply that these were already prehistoric and forgotten monuments. No one knows who built them. In the earliest mentions of these pyramids, it is said that God made them. In the earliest mentions of the Egyptian pyramids, they were the tombs of gods. So their actual age is hard to say. Perhaps they were long before the coming of even the hypothetical and extremely mysterious Toltecs. In any event, these buildings stood. And some of the older mazes perhaps also had the ornaments and symbols of the feathered serpent. One of these symbols was smuggled out of Mexico not too long ago after being stolen from one of these temples and offered for sale here in the United States. It was a figure of Quetzalcoatl, supposedly from one of the pyramids of the San Juan complex. So it's possible that we are dealing with a combination of factors, that this deity represents an archetypal concept of God, that this deity became embodied through his sons, and that it is sent of great teachers, great initiate priests, even great princely rulers of those ages, like the Osirian rulership of prehistoric Egypt, that these have had the same names, that they have descended, that their lives and numerous activities have been confused, and that is why, even in attempting to piece the lives of these men together, we find so many inconsistencies. There may have well have been more than one. If so, we are inclined to assume that they were correct when they claimed that it was this Quetzalcoatl, or at least one of them, who, seated in a cave with the Great Earth Mother, revealed the Tonalamatl, or the mysterious calendar, which gave them the Sun-Venus system of reckoning. For it is true in this calendar, the calendar of Central America, that you can identify correctly any day of any year for hundreds of thousands of years, with almost no difficulty whatsoever, through a series of interlocking calendar devices. We have never developed anything like it in our culture whatever. It is again attributed to the god of the feathered serpent. All these things point to part of this initiate culture. But these people may very well have drifted north, or they may also have resulted from people drifting south from a more northerly region. And I have always felt that if we wanted to understand the true position or the true religion of these mysteries of Central America, that we would do very well to examine the rather shallower remains of our North American tribes. For it is very possibly here that we would see the archetypal devices. We would see the original patterns. Now, there are two ways in which we can approach this. One is to suspect that these migrants, wandering from the north downward, left some of their tribes behind. Some of their wanderers, perhaps, did not wish to make the long journey, broke off and did not become part of a parent culture, remained comparatively primitive, and provided the wandering tribes of our North American Amerindian group. Or it is possible that stragglers or persons seeking colonization opportunities at a remote time broke away from the southern culture and came up here.